Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Sunday Monitor. This is Mark Rabawi along with Pokey Anderson. Tonight's show will include no mentions of Terry Schiavo, Michael Jackson, or steroids in baseball. Maybe we'll save those for next week. This week's show features two live interviews. Actually, not one of them is not live. The first interview, which I recorded earlier, is on Syria and Lebanon. I spoke with a British academic, Jørn Nielsen. The second interview will be a live interview, and that will be with Melinda Tuhus. Nielsen is a longtime academic who specializes in Islamic studies. Tuhus is a Connecticut-based journalist. You will have heard her on FSRN, perhaps, or Wings. You may have read her work in the New York Times. Pokey speaks with her later on. She's going to look, I think, at a fairly wide range of subjects, from the School of the Americas to women in the media to depleted uranium. So there's a little bit of something for everyone in there, apart from maybe Terry Schiavo or Michael Jackson. We have a lot of that coming up. We'll start, obviously, with the news summary. Stay tuned here to the Sunday Monitor on KPFT Houston. We'll start with a news headline from Pokey.
Thank you, Mark. More than 20 students ended their 9-day hunger strike for higher wages and better benefits for university contract workers on Thursday. The Georgetown University students in Washington, D.C. celebrated their victory by dancing in a ring, singing along with the guitar, cheering, and eating strawberries one bite at a time. They had taped a blue banner over their huge living wage sign and announced, "We all won." Two students had already gone to the hospital for weakness from the hunger strike. Protesters had wondered if they were in a futile battle and how much longer they could go on. But they got together, talked about how long they could go, and said, "Let's keep trying." Thursday evening, Georgetown President John DeGioia approved a proposal to increase total compensation for contract workers at the university from a minimum of $11.33 an hour to $13 by July, with a further increment by July 2007. The proposal also affirms workers' rights to organize without intimidation and offers them access to fringe benefits, such as English as a second language classes. During negotiations, the raises were estimated to cost the university nearly $500,000 over the next 2 years, but student activists said money should not be an issue. The university, they noted, raised $15 million for a new boathouse on the Potomac and was seeking $120 million for a business school. After the victory, protester Liam Stack told Susan Kinsey of the Washington Post, quote, "We were stunned. This is a real victory." The 400 workers affected, many of whom do janitorial work, security, or food service, have been checking in on the students, bringing them water and vitamins, usually late at night, during the hunger strike. When they learned of the victory, they were jumping up and down, clapping, smiling, and thanking students, while the students thanked them. One said, "Without them, we would have gotten nothing." Eleanor Holmes Norton, a professor at Georgetown's law school, was one of those who met along with administrators, students, and union members to finalize the agreement. Georgetown's president said the change is, quote, "an appropriate next step for us." He taught some of the protesters in classes on human rights, he told the Washington Post, and has repeatedly urged students to engage in social justice issues. "There is an irony here," he said and laughed. Similar conversations are taking place across the country, said Tom Jurovich, director of the Labor Relations and Research Center at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Some of these conversations grow out of anti-sweatshop movements of the last decade. As students have protested working conditions of overseas employees, they had also started looking at workers close to home, he said. One of the hunger strikers, part of the Georgetown Living Wage Coalition, freshman Jack Mahoney, lost 10 pounds on his frame, down to 135 pounds. After 9 days of hunger, dizziness, and protest, he ate a strawberry to celebrate. "It was amazing," he said.
Well, moving on to military news, I think, actually, Pokey, your next headline also mentions the U.S. military, so these two will go well together. U.S. Army documents say that American soldiers violated the Geneva Conventions and tortured Iraqi prisoners at a military base in Mosul, but nobody was ever court-martialed over the abuse. The documents show that mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners was not confined to the Abu Ghraib jail, where abuse and sexual humiliation of inmates caused worldwide outrage last year. An investigation by a U.S. officer after an Iraqi prisoner's jaw was broken at the base of Mosul found that, quote, "detainees were being systematically and intentionally mistreated," unquote. This is as of 2003. It doesn't stop there, however. Despite recommendations by Army investigators, commanders have decided not to prosecute 17 U.S. soldiers implicated in the deaths of three prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2003 and 2004. This is according to a new accounting released on Friday by the Army. Investigators had recommended that all 17 soldiers be charged in the cases, according to the accounting by the Army Criminal Investigations Command. The charges included murder, conspiracy, and negligent homicide. While none of the 17 will face any prosecution, one received a letter of reprimand and another was just discharged after the investigations. To date, the military has taken steps towards prosecuting some three dozen soldiers in connection with a total of 28 confirmed or suspected homicides of detainees. The total number of such deaths is believed to be between 28 and 31. This is according to several news sources. There are deaths considered suspected homicides. However, according to a CBS report, at least 108 people have died in American custody in Iraq and Afghanistan, most of them violently. This is according to government data provided to the Associated Press. Roughly a quarter of those deaths have been investigated as possible abuse by U.S. personnel. That figure, however, is far higher than any previously disclosed. It includes cases investigated by the Army, Navy, CIA, and the Justice Department. Just to put this in context for you, this figure of 108 prisoners is a little bit less than the 114 U.S. prisoners of war killed during the entire Vietnam War.
According to CBS News, some 5,500 U.S. soldiers have deserted since the invasion of Iraq started. A generation ago, in a time when U.S. soldiers were drafted, some 30,000 to 50,000 Americans fled to Canada during the Vietnam War and were allowed to settle there. But now, even though Canadian citizens tend to be against the war in Iraq, Canada's legal system has not put out the welcome mat this time around. A U.S. Army paratrooper lost in a decision of the Canadian Immigration Board this week. Jeremy Hinsman was denied political asylum in Canada, a ruling that dealt a blow to other deserters in Canada who argue such military duty would force them to commit atrocities against civilians. In December, Hinsman told Amy Goodman that, quote, "every justification or rationale that we have ever offered for going to Iraq has been bogus," unquote. He felt it was his duty to disobey. But the panel in Canada refused to consider evidence that the U.S. war in Iraq is illegal. An immigration board ruled that Hinsman had not convinced its members he would face persecution or cruel and unusual punishment if he is returned to the United States. Seven other American military personnel have applied for refugee status, and Hinsman's lawyer estimated dozens of others are hiding in Canada waiting to see how the government would rule. Hinsman remains in Canada pending appeal. One of the military's controversial policies is to force soldiers to stay in the military longer than they expected, longer than they volunteered for. It's called stop loss. Some call it a backdoor draft. One example is Carl Webb from Austin, Texas. He enlisted in the Texas National Guard in 2001 after a seven-year break from the U.S. military. He expected to serve for only 3 years. But in July 2004, less than 2 months short of his service completion date, the military told Webb that under the stop-loss program, he would serve 525 more days and that his unit was being deployed to Iraq. Webb deserted. The stop-loss program, which made its first appearance in the Gulf War of the early 1990s, keeps U.S. soldiers scheduled for deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan from leaving when their term of service ends. Quoting Carl Webb, "this policy is practically an unofficial draft. It is conscription against a person's will." Steve Morse of the GI Rights Hotline says that the number of calls they've received has grown from 17,000 in 2001 to more than 32,000 in 2004. He says about 30% are from soldiers who are AWOL or thinking about going AWOL. Army recruiters are feeling the stress of trying to get more people to sign up for military service. According to an excellent article appearing in today's New York Times by Damian Cave, even the recruiters are going AWOL. At least 37 members of the Army Recruiting Command, which oversees enlistment, have gone AWOL since October 2002. Cave writes that the Army's goal is over 100,000 new active duty Army and Reserve soldiers this year. That's just to replenish the ranks in Iraq and Afghanistan, around the world and at home. That means each of the Army's 7,500 recruiters has a quota of 2 new recruits a month. Even before the war, recruiters were contacting an average of 120 people before landing one active duty recruit. The number they have to contact is growing. One recruiter in the New York area said that when he steps outside his office for a cigarette, he is often barraged with epithets from passers-by angry about the war. An Army chaplain said he had counseled nearly a dozen recruiters in the past 18 months to help them cope with marital troubles or job-related stress. Some recruiters said they'd rather be in Iraq being shot at than to continue with their recruiting jobs. For the first time in nearly 5 years, the Army missed its active duty recruiting goal in February. The Reserve missed its monthly quota ever since October. The Marines also missed monthly recruiting goals in January for the first time in a decade.
Well, staying with military news for a while, military hardware in this case, President Bush has rewarded Pakistan for being an ally in the war on terror on Friday by authorizing the sale of F-16 fighter jets, a move that has reversed 15 years of policy begun under his father, and that India has warned would destabilize the region. The United States barred the sale of F-16s to Pakistan in 1990 out of concern that its then undeclared nuclear weapons program had consequences for the region as a whole. President Bush has forged a close relationship with Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf since September of 2001, however, and considers his help crucial in the battle against Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Pakistan initially looks to purchase about 24 F-16s, but Bush administration officials said that there would be no limit to how many it could eventually purchase, but they did at the same time try to balance the news of the sale by announcing on the same day that U.S. firms would have the right to provide India the next generation of sophisticated multi-role combat aircraft, including upgraded F-16s and F-18s, as well as develop broader cooperation in military command and control, early warning detection, and missile defense systems. Condoleezza Rice said in an interview with the Washington Post, quote, "We are trying to do this. What we are trying to do is solidify and extend relations with both India and Pakistan at a time when we have good relations with both of them, something most people didn't think could be done, and at a time they are improving relations with one another. If you look at it in terms of the region," she added, "what we are trying to do is break out of the notion that this is a hyphenated relationship somehow, that anything that happens that is good for Pakistan is bad for India and vice versa," unquote. Don't forget that this is the Near East and Soviet affairs specialist who failed to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. So she is now applying her extensive expertise to Indian-Pakistani relationship. We'll have to watch that closely and hope that she has better luck with this one. Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh complained about the sale of the F-16s. He said they would shift the balance of power in South Asia. He said, quote, "We are greatly disappointed to hear the news." Bush called Singh the Friday morning from Crawford, Texas, explaining the sale. And the Indian press has taken note of this agreement, and they have basically called it a concession paid in exchange for the sale of those fighter jets to Pakistan.
Once again, investigation has revealed that much more information on airline passengers has been gathered by the government than previously thought. This story has been dribbling out piecemeal for several years. On Friday, reports the Associated Press, the acting Inspector General of the Homeland Security Department said that the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, had misinformed individuals, the media, and Congress in 2003 and 2004. It stopped short of saying TSA lied. The report says the TSA misled the public about its role in obtaining personal information on millions of airline passengers. The TSA had a much broader role in getting and using passenger data than had been previously revealed. Between February 2002 and June 2003, TSA had a role in over a dozen transfers of data involving at least 12 million records obtained without passengers' knowledge or consent from America West, American Airlines, Continental, Delta, Frontier, and JetBlue. The report said, quote, "TSA officials made inaccurate statements regarding these transfers that undermined public trust in the agency. These misstatements were apparently not meant to mischaracterize known facts. Instead, they were premised on an incomplete understanding of the underlying facts. Again, that was quoting the report. Airline passenger data can include name, credit card information, phone number, and address. The TSA says it is using airline passenger data to test a computerized system for screening passengers called Secure Flight. Friday's report concluded that the TSA was inconsistent in protecting passengers' privacy as it developed a pre-screening system. It did acknowledge that the agency's environment for privacy had improved substantially. Another report is due on Monday. The report cites several occasions where TSA officials made inaccurate statements about passenger data, such as in September 2003, the agency's Freedom of Information Act staff received hundreds of requests from JetBlue passengers asking if the TSA had their records. After a cursory search, the Freedom of Information Act staff posted a notice on the TSA website saying it had no JetBlue passenger data. Though the staff found JetBlue passenger records in TSA's possession in May, the notice stayed on the website for more than a year. In November 2003, TSA Chief James Loy incorrectly told the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee that certain kinds of passenger data were not being used to test passenger pre-screening. Over a year ago, a previous story by the Washington Post had reported that a Freedom of Information Act request filed by the Electronic Privacy Information Center revealed that information on millions of airline passengers was provided to NASA for a secret U.S. government air security project soon after September 11, 2001. The nation's fourth largest airline, Northwest, asserted then that it, quote, did not provide that kind of information to anyone, unquote. Later, it acknowledged that that was not true. It had already turned over 3 months of reservation data to NASA's Ames Research Center. JetBlue had also acknowledged previously that it turned over records on over a million passengers to a defense contractor.
Well, that does it for the news for today. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we have an interview that I carried out actually just before the show started with a British academic, and we talk about Syria and Lebanon extensively, so stay tuned for that. Well, just before the show started, I was able to reach and record Professor Jørn Nielsen in the UK. He's a professor of Islamic theology at the University of Birmingham. He's lived and traveled extensively in the Middle East. He's written about the changing nature of the relationship between Syria and Lebanon. It's been in the news a lot, of course, Syria and Lebanon. You would have seen the two demonstrations. The first one, the anti-Syria demonstration, which was about 20,000 strong, which got a lot of press in the United States. The following one, which was about 500,000 strong, that didn't get nearly as much press, was a pro-Hezbollah, pro-Syria demonstration. So Syria has been in the news a lot, and it's been accused of allowing people to go through the borders to fight in Iraq. And it's kind of a complicated story, and I wanted to start off the discussion with Professor Nielsen about how Syrian troops actually ended up in Lebanon in the first place.
It goes way back beyond the Syrian troops. And so far as the history is concerned, when the Ottoman Empire broke down at the end of the First World War and the French took over the northern part of the Arab provinces, that included what later became Syria and Lebanon. And in the mid-1920s, the French carved out Lebanon from their Syrian mandate, making it into a separate state against the objections of probably the majority of the Arab population of the period. Both Syria and Lebanon, in practice, accepted it, although in theory, there was always a special relationship in such a way that from the 1920s right up through to the Civil War, there was never a Syrian embassy in Beirut, nor was there a Lebanese embassy in Damascus. There was a special relationship. Then when the Civil War broke out, the Syrians were seriously concerned about the impact on their interests, and above all, they were concerned that events in Lebanon should not force them into regional actions, policies that they were not, or they did not feel they were in control of. So during the spring and summer of 76, when it looked as if nationalist, the leftist forces in Lebanon, in alliance with the Palestinians, were about to win the civil war, the Syrians moved into Lebanon in force and defeated the leftist forces and effectively saved the phalangists, who in effect never accepted that they had been saved by the Syrians. Very quickly they got annoyed at what they saw as Syrian occupation. Through the rest of the civil war, the Syrians tended to play a balance of power policy, so that whenever one side was gaining the advantage, the Syrians would switch to the other side to keep a balance of power until in the late 1980s, 1990, things settled down. An agreement was made to end the civil war. By then, of course, the Israelis had been in the country very heavily since 1978.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, actually, because the term phalangist is, for most people, they've heard it in the context of Sabra and Shatila.
Yeah.
And the phalangist relationship with Israel kind of complicates this whole picture. Is there any way you can draw a couple of threads through that to explain it?
It complicates if you've got a short-term view. In the long term, it's not complicated. Because the phalangists were the militant nationalist party of the Maronite Christians, and have existed since the 1930s. And Maronite Christian nationalists were those who, at the end of the First World War, persuaded the French to establish this Lebanese state as primarily as a homeland for the Maronite Christian community, but in the process expanding it enormously to include significant populations of non-Maronite Christians, both Muslims, Sunnis and Shia, but also Greek Orthodox and various other forms of Christians who did not necessarily feel much affinity to the Maronites. And there's an ongoing history of connections, links, liaison between hardline Maronites going back to the First World War, right up through the 1970s and 80s, initially with Zionist organizations, and then finally after 1948 with Israel. So the fact that the phalangists got involved with the Israelis, and then ultimately, of course, in the extreme, in the case of the massacres in Sabra and Shatila, really is not a complication as much as a confirmation of previous history.
So the Syrians were in there during the civil war, and then they were in there by agreement, I guess, with the Arab League and the Taif Accord. What is it do you think that changed, apart from the assassination of Rafiq Hariri? What is it that happened that has now forced them to consider leaving seriously, and actually the majority have left?
Well, the Taif Accord was comparatively clear that there were two occupying powers at that time in 1990, this was 1991, in Lebanon, namely the Israelis and the Syrians. And the understanding of the Taif Accord was that the two occupying powers should move out. Ultimately, of course, the Israelis finally did in 2000 under pressure from Hezbollah, in the event the Syrians did not. But over the many years of Syrian involvement in Lebanon, there was clearly a faction within the Syrian government that regarded Lebanon as a protectorate, much like the relationship between mainland China and Hong Kong, a special relationship which meant that Lebanon and Syria had to be kept very closely related to each other. On the other hand, at the same time, there was equally clearly a situation where elements within the Syrian regime and within the Lebanese regime had common interests of a business and economic nature. So you began to get interlinkages between the security services in both countries and business interests, which meant that there were serious Syrian interests in Lebanese commerce, Lebanese political stability, which brought in elements of common intelligence activity as well as corruption, where a lot of Lebanese resources via corrupt routes disappeared into Syria.
So since the invasion and occupation of Iraq, a lot of U.S. pressure has been applied towards Syria. Do you think that, I mean, we still don't know who was behind the assassination of the former prime minister, but do you think that the U.S. was waiting for something to happen to be able to ratchet up the pressure, or do you think that this timing was purely coincidental?
I think in one sense the timing of the murder of Fihri was coincidental, but as you suggest, it's quite clear that, to my mind anyway, that the U.S., in the current state of affairs, is waiting ready to pounce on anything that it can use against Syria. Syria is a fly in the ointment of U.S. policy in the Middle East. However, U.S. Military resources seem to be so heavily tied up in Iraq that they haven't got sufficient resources to engage directly in military pressure on Syria, so they seem to be engaging in various indirect pressures and getting together with France, ironically, on Security Council Resolution 1559, calling on the Syrians to withdraw from Lebanon was one route of pressure. Putting pressure on the Syrians with accusations that the Syrians' borders are virtually non-existent, so people can move in and out across into Iraq, is another move. And, of course, relations with Israel, especially over the Golan Heights and the remaining bits of the South Lebanese border, are another lever that the U.S. feel that they can use to put pressure on Syria.
Now, of course, there are a couple of things that need to be pointed out for you know, people who are not very familiar with the region and with UN resolutions and so on. 1559 calls on Syria to withdraw from Lebanon, but very little mention has been made of the resolutions that were passed regarding Israel not only leaving Lebanon, which it now has done for the most part. There are still some farms that are occupied in southern Lebanon, but also previous resolutions, you know, 242 and 338 and so on, calling on, you know, restoration of the 67 borders.
You can start quoting UN resolutions. 242 wasn't the first.
Right.
I mean, there are UN resolutions going right back to 1947 and 1948.
So what I was going to ask you is...
Iranians have been allowed to get away with ignoring UN resolutions left, right, and center, and everybody else has to obey them because
right.
It's people who are in power.
Yes, yeah, it's 70-plus resolutions now that Israel is in violation of. So what I was going to ask you, since you've traveled to Syria and Lebanon several times, are people taking 1559 seriously, or do they see it as a double standard? I mean, what's the general opinion of people they've met out there about this resolution and also about how U.S. and Israeli policies deal with Middle Eastern countries in general?
I mean, generally, there's enormous anger and cynicism, which is a dangerous mixture at the best of times, enormous anger and cynicism at the double standard of appealing to U.N. resolutions. On the part of the U.S. and Britain in particular. U.N. resolutions applying to Syria, to Iraq and Iran have to be obeyed. U.N. resolutions applying to Israel can be ignored. 1559, I think in the region, certainly outside Lebanon, and I'm pretty certain within significant parts of Lebanon, are seen as yet another maneuver on the part of the great powers, primarily the U.S., working with Israel to push through what the region, what people in the region essentially sees as an Israeli agenda. Whether this is true or not is a different issue. The fact is that the people, the Arab in the street, and he certainly has some of my sympathy, the Arab in the street sees U.S. policy as an arm of Israel, of Israeli policy in the region.
So what hope is there then for, you know, stability in the region if this is the case? And do you see Israeli and American efforts to do something about this image, to address the issues?
Image is one thing. I mean, we hear about new appointments in the State Department to improve the U.S. image in the region. And this is something that's been going on for many years, the attempt to set up U.S.-sponsored satellite television station in the Middle East over Iraq. Al-Hurra is just another example of basically an analysis in Washington that suggests that the problem is image. The problem is not image. The problem is policy substance. And only when policy substance will change will the image change.
And have you seen any trends over the last couple of decades that there is any shift in policy in real terms?
If there has been a shift in policy, it's been in the wrong direction. It's been in the direction of an ever stronger support of Israeli perspectives on the region.
So in the sense of, in the context of the Lebanese-Syrian relationship, where do you see things going now? It seems like the majority of Syrian troops have already withdrawn, and the withdrawal should be complete fairly soon. What's going to be the next thing on the list that Washington and Tel Aviv are going to point to in terms of applying pressure on the Syrians?
They'll be looking at ensuring that Syria stops its support, whether in material terms or in moral terms, for the various movements, armed or otherwise, in the Arab world, primarily in Palestine and southern Lebanon, which are resisting Israeli occupation and Israeli expansion activities and the settlements and so on and so forth.
They had a close relationship with the Lebanese Falange initially, but what of the Syria relationship with Hezbollah, since that is now the prominent political and military grouping in Lebanon? I'm assuming Syria has a fairly close relationship with Hezbollah, and there's references occasionally that come across with Iran as well. What is the future?
There's no doubt that the Lebanese Hezbollah was founded very much at the initiative of the Islamic revolutionary government in Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
And it suited the Syrians, for their own reasons, to encourage that support. However, it's equally clear that the Lebanese Hezbollah are Lebanese. If there's a clash between what they view as their Lebanese priorities and what their allies in Tehran, for example, might view as larger Islamic revolutionary priorities, the Lebanese Hezbollah are going to follow their own priorities. And the Lebanese Hezbollah has, for a number of years now, been gradually and very, very, very shrewdly establishing itself and inserting itself as a mainstream Lebanese political party. It's also, its networks are also among the most successful resources for health services at the local grassroots level, village in the countryside, of basic education, provision of social services, which the Lebanese state is unable to provide. Equally, the Hezbollah has established itself, interestingly, right across the political and religious spectrum of Lebanon as the national resistance. They were the people who pushed the Israelis out in 2000, and they are the people who are defending the south of Lebanon against recurrent Israeli attacks. And it must be remembered that South Lebanon suffered from recurrent Israeli attacks going right back to the late 1960s. I lived there myself and knew villages there through the early 1970s. And they were constantly being attacked from across the border. And it was only when retaliations came back from north, from Lebanon into the Israeli side, that the Western media picked up on it. The Western media were on the whole not interested in Israeli incursions of a minor sort, harassment and so on across the border into Lebanon. It was only when the other side hit back with the odd rocket attack, and then that gave the Israelis the excuse for major invasions, and that's happened again and again.
So one final question, because I'm very conscious of your time, and I know it's late in England. What are the future of Hezbollah, with not only with the Syrian pullout, but also with the U.S. classification of it as a terrorist group? The French have refused to classify it as such. What is the future for Hezbollah in Lebanese politics? I know that's a difficult question to ask you, but if that could be our last one today.
It is a difficult one. Not only the French who have refused to classify Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, even the British, despite their very close relationships with Washington, have refused to classify Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. And so long as there's not an internationally accepted definition of terrorism rather than one that has been defined to current conveniences from Washington, I don't think it can be justified to call Hezbollah a terrorist organization. Their future, it seems to me, lies in Lebanese politics, partly in defending the interests of the Shiite population, who for decades were the most disadvantaged part of the Lebanese population. But also, now I think their role lies in defending, representing a wider section of the Lebanese population, both in terms of national dignity and defense of the South, but also in terms of, I suppose, what we in Europe would call a social democratic party, the political party that defends the interests of people who are otherwise disadvantaged by those who own land, who own companies, and so on and so forth.
Do you see any internal struggle for them in the same terms as IRA and Sinn Féin are having, you know, regarding political versus military participation in a struggle?
I don't think there are those internal contradictions. I don't think the situations are comparable.
Okay.
Superficially, they may be. I don't think there are the internal contradictions between what you might call the political and the military wing that we see with the IRA and Sinn Féin.
All right. Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us and for taking the time to stay up and answer some questions.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. That was Professor Ewan Nielsen of Birmingham University in the UK. I had initially identified him as a professor of Islamic theology. He's actually a professor of Islamic studies. Hopefully that clears up his title, and also hopefully the interview helps you understand Lebanese-Syrian relations and a little bit more of the background. We're going to take a very short break right now, and we'll come back with a live interview. Stay tuned.
Thank you, Mark. Melinda Tuhus is a journalist based in Connecticut. She's done reports for Free Speech Radio News and Wings. Sometimes she does reports for the Connecticut Weekly section of the New York Times. And she was also given a first place award for her work at WQUN. She contributes segments to a magazine radio show that's a little bit like this show. It's called Between the Lines in Connecticut. And she also has a master's in journalism. Welcome to the show, Melinda.
Thanks very much, Pokey. Nice to be talking to you.
It's great to have you. It was great fun looking at the Between the Lines topics for a while, and seeing that some of the things that you guys think up there are very similar to the things we think up down here in Houston.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of similarity and a certain overlap in guests and certainly in issues.
Yeah. The issues just don't seem to go away, do they?
Right, right. It's not hard to fill a half hour or an hour in your case, I guess.
Right. So you just got back from a Women in Media conference. Tell us what was going on there. What were people talking about?
It was a really good conference. It was the second one. Last year they had it in Boston. This year they had it in Cambridge, and right outside of Boston. It was called Women in the Media. This year it was called Taking Our Place in the Public Conversation. And there were a couple of keynote addresses. There were lots and lots of workshops. There were about 200 women there for part or all of the weekend. And really, it was there was just such a buffet of really interesting topics and very women with so many experiences and accomplishments, people who have been, you know, working in various aspects of the media for, in some cases, for decades. Medea Benjamin opened the conference on Friday night, and I've heard her speak before, but this speech was just, it was really fantastic, and right on the topic of, you know, women and the media. So she talked about, she told a lot of stories, but sort of the thrust of her piece was, you know, even though mainly through the group, you know, that she co-founded, Code Pink, they'd been very successful at getting media coverage, but from the corporate media, what they mostly get is sort of, you know, isn't this cute kind of, you know, not really dealing with the issues that they're raising and raising, you know, in a way that it seems like it should be graspable to anybody, really. But she was saying that they, you know, even though they are pretty good at taking actions and so on that attract the media, they still are having a hard time, you know, getting the kind of coverage that they would hope to get for their issues in a way that, you know, might change the minds, really. So that's, it's an ongoing struggle. But a lot of the workshops were dealing with, well, a lot of different things, actually. I was on a panel talking about radio, women in radio, because there's a lot of the conference, people who come to the conference, and I think the organizers tend to be a little leaning heavily on the print side. So we did a workshop. We pitched a workshop, and they wanted us to do one on women in radio. And so that was good. And there definitely were other radio, you know, we weren't the only ones, but it was good to sort of put that in the mix.
What was the, was there any conversation about this ruckus about there not being enough women in the top op-ed pages around in the print media?
Yeah, that was quite a major topic. There was a workshop dedicated to that. And then on Sunday, we had what they called an action brunch where Daisy Hernandez spoke, who has been associated with Ms. Magazine and other publications, but she sort of kicked it off. And then we broke into workshops again, or more like brainstorming sessions, I guess. And one of the five was specifically about, you know, how to get women and progressive women's voices into op-eds. I mean, the statistics are pretty bad in terms of just women, you know, any women. But then if you break it down further and see, you know, who the women are that are getting published, there's certainly not as many, you know, with progressive kind of politics.
And there's similar numbers if you look at the Sunday morning talk shows.
Oh, yeah, which I really don't watch very often. But, you know, I've sort of walked past the TV when it's been on sometimes and noticed that. Yeah, that's definitely true. So yeah, people had ideas, and the organizers set up an email list for anybody, you know, everybody who wanted to be a part of it. And as soon as I got home, I stayed in Boston an extra day, and by the time I got home, my inbox was kind of flooded with emails. So people were very excited. It was also, I should say, I missed her talk, but I just wanted to mention there was another keynote address in the morning, and that was Jill Nelson, which I unfortunately didn't get to hear because my panel, we hadn't met each other until we got to Boston, so we were finishing planning our workshop that morning. So I missed that, but I heard it was, you know, people were again very kind of excited and upbeat about that. There was also a workshop during the weekend, and also a breakout group at the end about how to get money for, you know, progressive media endeavors. And I found that very helpful. That was actually the one that I went to, and I found that very helpful. So there's actually, you know, there's a lot of women out there doing a lot of these different things, you know, writing books and, you know, being involved in all aspects of the media, and also being involved in grants, you know, in granting organizations. One thing I learned was that there's a group in, I guess, based in Madison, that is specifically how it's an organization for women philanthropists, teaching women how to give money away. And I thought I'm going to follow up on that.
And yeah, good deal.
Yeah, to see what I can find out. But you know, there was a lot of A lot of energy, a lot of excitement, tons and tons of networking going on. So I think it was I think it was really a very worthwhile way to spend the weekend, and they're already planning, starting to plan next year. So it's organized by a group in the Boston Cambridge area, Center for New Words, which
started out
as a bookstore.
Great women's bookstore, yes.
Many, many years ago, it was a women's bookstore, and it sort of converted into what's now, you know, called the Center for New Words. And this is one of the main projects that they do, but they do a lot of other. They don't sell books right now, but they do. They support women in the media, women in book publishing, and just try to serve as a conduit and as a organizing.
Yeah, I know some of those gals. They're great.
Yeah, really.
So let's keep moving here. You are based in Connecticut, and yet you recently went to South Africa to report there. They barely send me downtown here. How did you get to go to South Africa?
Well, I freelance, so I didn't have anybody to send me, but the brief story is I had done my husband and I had done South Africa solidarity work back in the late 70s and early 80s, and he actually got sent by his job, and so I went with him. And even though then we split up when we got there, we weren't together most of the time. I went to Johannesburg and went to just interviewed people. I stayed in the hotel that was like two blocks from this 12-story building that was filled with NGOs, and so I got to interview people there and got tips from them about where else to go and who to interview. And I spent an overnight on the weekend in Soweto, which was really an amazing experience. It was very, very exciting for me because I had never been there, and I had done a lot of work for 4 years. It was almost practically some of the time full-time volunteer work on that issue. So I knew a lot about it at the time, and then all this time had gone by, and I was really curious to see how things were there. And also actually met up again with an old friend from Boston who was South African, who had left the country, was part of the ANC, the African National Congress, and then went back in the early 90s and is living there now. So it was just an amazing experience. I focused on women and violence and AIDS, HIV/AIDS, and sort of the intersection of those things. And got to interview people who, at the university, who were doing research, and interviewed women themselves who were staying in shelters. And it was very active when I was there. It was a year ago, so it was not, it didn't just happen, but when I was there a year ago in March, it was just before the rollout of the antiretroviral drugs that they were going to start finally making available to, a relatively small number of people, but hopefully expanding it. So I talked to women who were HIV positive and were working in that struggle, and like just a couple years before I went, a woman who had identified herself as HIV positive was murdered. So it was, it was not a small thing for people to be going public, but as more people did, it wasn't quite as life threatening for them to do it.
One of the most, I like statistics, but I have to say one of the most stunning statistics I have gathered in the last few years is the one that says that the number of people who have HIV/AIDS in Africa is nearly the equivalent to the entire population of Canada. It's 29 million compared to 32 million. And, that number tries to, give a person a grasp of how big this problem is.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's been foot dragging by governments there. There's been promises made by this government of donations of money, and those promises have been broken. So, do you see things moving along in any kind of pace at all there?
Well, it can be pretty discouraging, but there definitely is. People are now getting the ARVs, the antiretrovirals. I don't know current numbers. It's still a small percentage. There's 5 million people just in South Africa who have HIV. And what I find stunning in terms of statistics is the life expectancy now in some of those countries is in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is really mind-boggling to me. But, you know, you see how it happens, and then you see, you know, millions of orphans. It can be pretty overwhelming. But, you know, I visited programs that I think were making progress. You know, they're very tiny given the problems. But there are people, you know, with some clout who are in the government or in NGOs who, you know, are really calling for these kind of changes. And also, obviously, there has to be support out from outside, because South Africa, as far as I know, makes little or none of its own, you know, AIDS drugs. I'm not positive about that, but when I was there, I don't think they were making it any. So, you know, they would get them from India, or, you know, they wanted to get them from the U.S. if the price could be, you know, low enough. But I actually just read a kind of disturbing news story that India is changing its patent laws so that it's going to be potentially, it's not totally clear yet, but potentially in the not-too-distant future, a lot more expensive to buy those kind of drugs, like the combination drugs that's just like one pill instead of people having to take like half a dozen pills for AIDS. And that could be really bad, but, you know, it's a little unclear what the impact's going to be. But it didn't sound good. It sounded like it was going in the wrong direction.
You've also, although I don't think you've been to Iraq, you've reported on depleted uranium and its use in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, one of the numbers there is that stuff used by the U.S. military has a half-life of 4-point-something billion years.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's just another unimaginable kind of a number.
Yeah.
That this is not just going to happen, you know, for all the generations we can think of, but for basically as many years as the Earth has probably existed.
Yeah.
That this stuff's going to be around, and it's just, it's unfathomable. And in looking at, you know, the AIDS problem in Africa and just the general poverty and, you know, the kinds of things that are going on in the war zones, I want to read you a sentence from Bill Moyers, an article that has been released. He's written it several times and kind of rewritten, and this one's called Welcome to Doomsday from the New York Review of Books, published on March 24th by Bill Moyers. He opens the article saying, quote, "There are times when what we journalists see and intend to write about dispassionately sends a shiver down the spine, shaking us from our neutrality." And he goes on and talks about all kinds of things like theocracy and, you know, no kind of a commitment to protect the natural environment and all kinds of things. But as a journalist, as you're reporting on things that are true, like HIV/AIDS or depleted uranium or any of the other number of things you talk about, criminal justice system, how does it affect you emotionally, and how do you retain a commitment to tell the truth, even though you wonder whether your listeners might want to go, you know, escape?
You mean tell the truth when the truth is really unpleasant? Is that?
Yeah, and even difficult to fathom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it is important to get as much information as one can on all sides of an issue and to really understand it. And I think, I mean, I mean, this whole discussion of, you know, objectivity or not objectivity, I mean, and anybody who sort of looks into that or pursues that to any degree will, you know, can point out all these reasons, all these ways in which, you know, so-called objective reporters aren't objective, even if they try to be objective. So I think,
sure.
I mean, but on the other hand, I mean, there's also a difference between, you know, just presenting one side of an issue. I mean, I don't think that's really that helpful, in the sense of, you know, it's good to know what the other side thinks, and then, you know, what both sides or all sides think, and then, you know, listeners hopefully can help, you know, can help them draw their own conclusions. But I like reporting on stories that I care about, and I think that comes through a lot in my reporting, or at least I hope it does. I mean, I you know, because if I didn't care about an issue, why would I want to even why would I even want to learn about it? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I mean, I do care about a lot of these things, and I like, you know, hearing people's stories and just trying to understand, you know, where kind of where they're coming from and how people, you know, how people arrive at the beliefs that they do. But I think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking a position, you know. I mean, having, studying an issue and learning about it from various sides and then deciding, you know, what, telling the truth, as you said. I mean, I think that that's an important thing to do, and not just, I hate stories that are sort of he said, she said.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel like some of the stories I work on, that's what I end up with, and it's, I find it to be very frustrating. I try to get past that, but sometimes, you know, I find it difficult sometimes because I'm not an expert in most of what I, well, most of what I cover. I mean, I do research and I do interviews and, you know, but it's not like I have, you know, 10 or 20 years of my own expertise in any given subject. So it's, sometimes it's, you know, I'm not even sure what the position, what the true story is, I guess you could say. But, you know,
I was just reading, we're talking with Robert McChesney about coming on and talking about some media issues, and he says that a good press or good media in a democracy has three jobs. One is to be a watchdog of the powerful. One is to present a range of informed views, and one is to sort out the difference between truth and not truth. So I think you make a great point there.
Yeah, well, I think it's not always easy to do those things.
Yeah, it's really not. Hey, we're running out of time, Melinda. I knew it would go fast.
Boy, it sure did.
Yeah, I was just like, woo. I've been talking with Melinda Tuhus, who is a reporter in Connecticut. And do you have any closing thoughts for us at Sunday Monitor?
Well, I think we didn't get to talk about the criminal justice issue and the death penalty issue, which is something that I'm very interested in. And we, you know, we were talking about some sort of contrast between Connecticut and in Texas, and it would have been fun to kind of explore that. But that's something that, you know, I'm going to be looking at ongoing, because we may have our first execution in all of New England for 45 years coming up here in Connecticut in the next 2 months. So that's something. And maybe I'll be talking to you to get more information about what's out in Texas.
Yeah, we'll have to stay in touch.
Yes, definitely.
Well, it's been great having you on, Melinda.
Thanks so much.
And I'll give it back to Mark. Thanks.
Thanks, Melinda. Just before, Melinda, you heard an interview I did with Jørn Nielsen, a professor of Islamic studies at the University of Birmingham in the UK. That does it for tonight's show. Coming up.